Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, 10 Cent, Tent Tax and Baby Shark. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
As ever, we
there.
Are...
Sorry, I forgot the there. That's fine. It'll all work.
As ever, we're going to be talking about... No, we're not. As ever, we're going to be taking a look, for God's sake.
Yeah, read your script. This is scripted. This bit of Setlist is scripted.
You threw me off. But we'll start again.
And he's already screwed it up, even though it's scripted.
You can cut this out.
Go on. As ever, we're going to be taking a look back through some... I'm predicting what Andy's going to say here. Through some of the biggest and most interesting...
No, I say the same thing every week.
Music industry news stories of the last 7 days. It really is the last 7 days this time. That's exciting.
Not.
Is it not?
No.
Did something happen 22 weeks ago?
I'm going to start again.
Oh, by the time this goes out, it'll be more than 7 days. You're right. As we speak, it is definitely the last 7 days.
This is all getting cut out. Stop recording
stuff.
No, go
on. As ever.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last 7 days. A week.
Aren't you impressed that I knew you were going to say that? Psychic me.
We cut all that out.
A week when...
We have to do it again now.
A week when...
No.
Harry Styles?
Leave me alone. We haven't got time. As ever, we're going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories.
Are you really suggesting that we're going to cut this? I think we should keep it all in. As ever, Harry Styles said in an interview...
Right, a week when Harry Styles said... This is just me laughing in a room now.
It sounds like... Do you know what it sounds like? Do you want to know what it sounds
What's
like?
It
sounds like you're having problems with your tongue this week, and that's why you're screwing it all up.
Right.
Did you bite off your tongue in a mushroom
No.
fueled frenzy? In a week.
Shut up. A week when Harry Styles said in an interview that he got so high on mushrooms while recording his new album that he'd bitten off the end of his tongue. That's One Direction's Harry Styles, everyone.
Well, high on mushrooms, biting off his own tongue.
Yes. But for his first solo album, he sort of tried to invent himself or reinvent himself. As like a 70s rock star, didn't he? And everyone was really impressed when that album came out because they were like, wow, it's like a 70s rock star.
Everyone.
And then you listened to it and went, no, it's not. It's like the guy from One Direction trying to be like a 70s rock star. I think everyone's bar was set so low that they were impressed by just anything.
Well, because they'd listened to the Zayn album.
But now... Oh, yeah. But now...
It was quite good, wasn't it, the Zayn album?
I don't know. I think I listened to it. But now... He's taking that kind of rock star cliche even further and he's just done loads of mushrooms and bitten off the end of his tongue.
Does that not make him a wannabe 60s rock star? Is he going backwards?
I think it could probably be either.
50s
maybe it's going,
on
maybe
the
he's
third
doing...
album. He'll be doing Second World War songs on his fourth album.
I look forward to that.
A bit of 1920s, kind of whatever 1920s music was on his fifth album.
The breadth of your knowledge is astounding.
I really should have written out a list of what music was big in what decade.
Do some music hall.
Bit of music hall, yes, and then Greensleeves. Is that right? Is that how far we've been gone backwards?
I look forward to Harry Styles' version of Greensleeves. We have to wait quite a while for it, though.
In your article,
mm-hmm.
for the purposes of comedy,
yeah.
you suggested...
Which is the only reason to write anything.
You suggested that Harry Styles might need to spend all of his pop star money...
Mm.
On tongue reconstruction surgery.
Yes. I don't think it would cost that much, but yeah.
And as a result, have to go and do a One Direction reunion.
Yes.
To get some more money.
It was tying up the whole thing.
I allowed that to go through.
Mm.
But when I was a child,
yeah.
I may have been a young teenager. I mean, it was probably before that. I'm pretty sure it was, actually. Actually, this is always more embarrassing the older I am when it occurs.
Okay.
So let's say I was 6.
Okay, so you were about 25.
I had something done at the dentist that required a local anaesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you say it? Anaesthetic. Anaesthetic.
Anaesthetic.
Getting that wrong. It's because my tongue's going mad. A local anaesthetic.
Yeah.
And I bit my tongue.
Yeah.
While it was all frozen.
Mm.
And didn't realise, because I didn't know that that could happen, because I was only 6, remember?
Yeah.
And
apparently.
It was quite a nasty wound. Like a big chunk of it was bitten out.
Are you actually talking about when... You had your teeth done, which I know how old you were when you did that. Or is this when you were actually a child?
This is when I was a child.
Okay, okay.
This is when I was 6, remember?
Right, so you are already lowering the age, but not by that much. You weren't in your 30s.
I wasn't in my 30s.
Okay.
And I was definitely a child. Okay. I was at the dentist with my mum.
Why did your mum come when you were in your 30s?
So this was when I was 6 years old. It was when I was younger. Anyway, the point is that when my mum then, I can't remember if we went back to the dentist or whether we actually went to the doctor. Anyway, I don't know. Somebody with a medical qualification said that the tongue is the bit of the human body that can just mend itself on its own.
Yeah.
And that person said you could cut your tongue in half and it would just mold itself back together.
Yeah.
It's the most mending itself bit of the human body.
Is
so therefore, however much of his tongue he bit off while high on mushrooms writing his crappy second album, he won't need any surgery, cheap or otherwise, to fix it. So it was factually incorrect.
Yeah, well, all right. Your I also
comedic final paragraph.
The tongue is quite prone to bleeding as well. I suspect he bit a small amount of his tongue.
And there was a lot of blood.
And there was a lot of blood. I don't think it was like an Itchy the Killer, half his tongue cut off.
Anyway.
With a knife.
The other thing to note is, at this stage,
everyone's seen Itchy the Killer, right?
I'm incredibly squeamish, so.
Yeah, I know. That's why I put this in to talk about.
Stop talking about Harry Styles and blood gushing out of his mouth as he sings while high on mushrooms. And let's talk about what we're here to talk about this week, which I know for a fact, because I pre-vetted the notes, involves no biting of tongues or pop star blood.
Does involve a shark attack.
Oh, that is true. And while you might be thinking, because you said baby shark in the intro, so people know what's coming up, well, the baby shark song doesn't involve any actual biting or blood.
Well, we'll get to that.
But
yes,
you'll discover that the original version does.
Mm.
So maybe only the first two-thirds of this are going to be blood-free. But let's get on with the blood-free bit of setlist.
Okay, this week we are going to be discussing a proposed tax on tents at festivals and a lawsuit claiming that Baby Shark is a rip-off. But first, Tencent Music is under investigation by China's competition regulator over the exclusivity deals that it has with the major labels.
Tencent Music being the music division of famous Chinese web giant, as we always say, Tencent. Obviously, Tencent Music has now been spun off as its own business, but still predominantly owned by the parent company, Tencent. And yes, this is about these exclusivity deals.
Do we ever call Google a web giant?
I do all the time.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
I call it an American web giant.
Okay. Do you?
Constantly.
Okay.
Are you suggesting that we're racist? And that
it's just a weird, it's quite a weird term, isn't it?
We only call Chinese web giants web giants. Anyway, these exclusivity deals have been a weird feature of the Chinese digital music market for quite a number of years now. So basically, what happened in the very early days of the Chinese streaming market, when everybody was still talking about the potential of the Chinese music market, but no one was to actually see any of that potential actually being realized.
Yeah.
People weren't making any money because everybody in China was still downloading music illegally via the search engine Baidu, but also other services as well. And what happened was, when people started to see the growth of the streaming market elsewhere in the world and thought, well, maybe we could get a legit licensed streaming market off the ground here in China, what the three majors decided to do was basically to get into bed with one Chinese web giant tech company, and that was Tencent.
Mm-hmm.
And we discussed all this at the China conference that we staged at the Great Escape a couple of years ago. And we had some people who were very much on the ground in China at the time that these deals were being done. And they explained that the logic initially was kind of sound, which was that the global record companies, the Western record companies, have been trying to fight piracy in China for a number of years, been trying to get legit digital music off the ground in China, have had some success when it comes to copyright law and having the government saying some stern stuff about Chinese copyright law. But nevertheless, the market hasn't really taken off. So if the majors ally with one Chinese web company, so that now their interests are in sync, maybe that web company can do whatever it needs to get a legit digital music market off the ground in China.
Yeah.
So that's why Sony, Universal, Warner, who had already been collaborating in China, initially they set up their own joint venture, and then they all did these deals with Tencent. And basically what those deals say is Tencent can use the majors' catalogs on its own streaming services, because Tencent actually operates three streaming services in China. Count them.
One, two, three.
Yeah, there you go. All three of them. So Tencent can use Sony Universal and Warner's music on its own services, but it also becomes the exclusive distributor of the majors' catalogue in the digital space in China. So what that means is, if anyone wants to set up a rival streaming service to one of the Tencent services, then in order to get Sony Universal Warner content, they have to go to Tencent, their competitor, to access the major label repertoire, which from a Western perspective seems a bit odd, although it has to be said, and there are plenty of critics of these exclusivity deals in China, although even those critics sometimes concede that that original idea of the majors, which is if we ally with Tencent and then get Tencent to get this business started, it did work, because after that deal had been done, Tencent went full on into streaming, and we do now have a licensed, legitimate streaming service with lots and lots of users bringing in all right money in that market. So initially, it kind of worked.
Yeah, and then since then, some of those newer rivals like NetEase Cloud Music started negotiating their own exclusivity deals, partly to improve their negotiating position when they went to Tencent, so that they could say, if you give us access to this catalogue, you can have this one that we've got the exclusivity on. So you can see they've tried to work out a system of sorts.
Yeah, and so NetEase, as you mentioned in particular, started to do its own exclusivity deals. Obviously, couldn't do exclusivity deals with the majors.
No, which
is kind of the point of exclusivity.
It's a bit of a problem. Because they therefore can't. Although they can improve their negotiating position, it's never going to be balanced unless they license a lot of other stuff exclusively.
Although, you say that, of course, when it comes to global repertoire, and particularly the Anglo-American repertoire, even though they have done deals, so NetEase did a deal with Cobalt, I think Alibaba, who are the other web company dabbling with digital music, did a deal with BMG. I think I'm right in saying that. I really should have checked it. But there's also all the local music rights owners. And given that actually, when you look at the user stats on those services, the majority of listening is domestic repertoire, and then within what would be classified international repertoire, actually Japanese and Korean music tends to perform the best. So I suppose if those other companies could sign up a decent amount of Chinese repertoire, then it may increase their negotiating power when it comes to trying to get access to the major label content via a Tencent deal. But nevertheless, these exclusivity deals that have been done, and particularly the Tencent exclusivity deals, they have made the Chinese market a bit weird, as I said at the start. Yeah. There's also the fact that some of the research suggests a lot of Chinese music fans install multiple services on their devices. So whereas probably in the UK, once you've installed Spotify, you predominantly use Spotify to access music. Or once you've installed Deezer, you predominantly install Deezer to access music. Whereas a lot of people in China install all of the apps, because no one of the apps has all the music.
Yeah, everyone's got gaps.
It has improved a bit in the last couple of years, but traditionally, no one service had all the music. So you install all of them so that if the track you want to listen to isn't on the service you've got open, you can shut that app, open another app and listen to it there, which on one level doesn't matter, except, of course, what the agenda of the global majors, and indeed the indies in Europe and North America, has been for the last few years, is to try and get people to move off the free ad-funded services that pay much lower royalties into the music industry onto the paid-for premium services. And whereas Spotify has done a pretty good job of converting, I mean, it still has slightly more free users than paid-for users, but a pretty damn good conversion rate in getting those free users onto the premium version. The shift over to premium in China is much, much, much smaller. And I think one of the reasons why premium is less attractive to Chinese users is the Chinese user is like, well, I need access to 3, 4, 5 services in order to have access to all the music. I don't want to have to pay to access 5 services.
Yeah.
So I'll just stay on the free versions and then I can access everything. So this slightly weird situation has had an impact on the evolution of the Chinese market as more services and non-Tencent services have started to gain some momentum.
Yeah, and so in most countries, certainly European and North American countries, a situation like this would have set off alarm bells with regulators pretty quickly, although in China it's been a bit slower to catch up, although it does seem now that the government is investigating the situation, so possibly planning to act and stop these exclusivity deals.
Yeah, so as well as the potential impact these exclusivity deals have had on how the Chinese streaming market has evolved, there is that point that from a UK, US, European perspective, the fact these exclusivity deals are allowed to exist seems odd because it does raise all sorts of competition law concerns. It is true that I think about 18 months ago, one government agency in China, I think it was the Copyright Agency in China, did start to put pressure on the streaming services about these exclusivity deals, in particular putting pressure on Tencent and NetEase and Alibaba to make sure that they did a better job of licensing each other their catalogues. So we have seen a slight improvement since then, although one of the complaints that has been raised and various reporting on this, I think it was Bloomberg that certainly brought this government investigation to wider attention in the last week. One of the complaints that have been cited in those reports, which we think initiated this government investigation, that actually began at the start of the year,
yeah. So
not a brand new investigation, but one of the gripes that seems to have been raised in the investigation and is then cited in the various reports about it in this last week, is that although Tencent may now be licensing on the major label catalogue that it has the exclusive rights to, the other services are finding it's always more expensive to access catalogue through Tencent than it is when you go and negotiate directly with labels, even non-Chinese labels.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly because in order to secure these exclusivity arrangements, Tencent has paid quite a big upfront advance, which is another reason why the majors quite liked these deals in
yeah. The
early days of the growth of the Chinese market. And maybe it's passing on the cost of securing those exclusivity deals to its rivals. But there's an element of, well, why have we got these exclusivity deals in the first place?
Yeah, so some people reckon that the result of this will be new regulation that will do away with these exclusivity deals. But actually, there's also an argument that the market might sort itself out because those deals are going to come up for renewal at some point. And now that the Tencent parent company is in the process of buying 10% of Universal Music, it's going to make it less likely that Warner and Sony are going to be renewing those deals.
Yeah, I think we mentioned that when we talked about the confirmation from Vivendi, the owner of Universal Music Group, that one of the people it was talking to about buying 10% of the Universal Music Company was Tencent. Is, well, what does that mean for Tencent Music's relationship ongoing with Sony and Warner? Actually, we didn't mention at the time, when Tencent Music went to its New York Stock Exchange listing, both Sony and Warner took some equity in the Tencent Music Company, and Tencent and Sony were working on a joint venture label. But you have to think that, assuming that deal goes ahead and Tencent does become an owner of 10% of Universal, Sony and Warner are going to start to have second thoughts about, is this a company we want to be in business with? Do we want to give them exclusive control over our catalogue in China? So as you say, it may well be that Sony and Warner don't want to renew those deals anyway when they come up for renewal. Although that's not to stop them going to a NetEase or an Alibaba and saying, how big an advance check would you give us to take control of our catalogue in China?
But it may well be that they see that stuff is happening at a government level, or maybe it'd be better now at this stage not to do exclusivity deals and do more direct deals with each company. As Merlin did last year, Merlin made quite a big deal of the fact that it hadn't done an exclusivity deal. It had done deals with all the services to get independent music onto those streaming services.
As for why the Chinese regulator might have decided earlier this year that now was the time to investigate these exclusivity deals and consider whether or not some regulation was required, which, as we've already said, is likely that regulation would have stopped these arrangements in many other countries already. But it may well be that some of Tencent's competitors have been complaining. So is that NetEase and Alibaba, etc., who have been dealing with this for a number of years? Although, as we've said, part of the solution on their side was to negotiate their own exclusivity deals with other catalogue. Also, since the Copyright Office, or whatever it's called in China, put some pressure on the services to be a little bit more proactive in licensing their respective catalogues, things have improved slightly. This is now me completely wildly speculating.
Ooh.
But it does occur to me that one company who has been entering the licensing domain much more recently is TikTok owner ByteDance, who has obviously been negotiating deals with music companies all over the world for the TikTok app, but is also thought to be considering entering the market with a more conventional streaming service as well. Now, that may be in China, it may be globally, it may be a combination of the two. But is it ByteDance, who have been very much in the music licensing mode, entering the party a little bit later than everybody else? I mean, there's probably nobody left to do an exclusivity deal with. Is it them who have been putting pressure on the Chinese regulators to look into this? I don't know. Just a little bit of wild speculation. But it will be interesting to see what the conclusions of this investigation are. And most importantly of all, whether or not any new rules come into force.
Still to come, did Pinkfong steal Baby Shark from an American children's entertainer? But now, campaign group Clean Up Britain has proposed a £25 refundable levy on festival tickets after images emerged of the campsites of the Reading and Leeds festivals once again covered in discarded tents after this year's events.
This is becoming almost an annual event, isn't it? Particularly after Reading and Leeds. I don't know, is it that it's a particular problem at Reading and Leeds, or do they have particularly big campsites, or is it just that they're better known festivals and so the mainstream news take the footage?
I think, and I don't want to disparage all young people, but
a younger audience goes to these festivals. Is that what you're saying?
They do have a younger audience, and young people are all just arseholes. So I know someone who works in sustainability at a university, and she was telling me it's quite hard to engage students with sustainability because a lot of them really just don't care. That is why my assumption is then transferred to the younger audience at Reading and Leeds just not being quite so engaged with not chucking stuff away.
Because, of course, we have been talking about this for a number of years now. After big festivals like Reading and Leeds, these photos do the rounds. Sometimes there are video footage of the clear-up going out on social networks.
There was an aerial photo last year that got everyone talking, wasn't it?
And there have been various attempts within the festival community to tackle this. Obviously, the Association of Independent Festivals have said quite a bit of stuff. And then earlier this summer, it did look like maybe the message was getting through.
Yeah, because Glastonbury announced that less than 1% of tents had been left behind at the festival. That's quite a dramatic turnaround from where we were. And so it seemed like really people had taken on board.
Because you might be thinking that, oh, well, Glastonbury's different because Glastonbury has a political element to it. It's a right-on element to it. So Glastonbury fans clearly never left their tents behind. That isn't a development, but they did.
Yes, they very much did.
Despite the political ethos of Glastonbury and sort of the environmental standing that that festival has traditionally taken, it was a problem at Glastonbury, but has improved. So as you say, a very small number of tents left. But Reading and Leeds, still a problem. Your theory being that maybe the average festival goer at Glastonbury is a little bit, or possibly a lot older than the average Reading Leeds fan.
Yeah, well, there's clearly something different because it's not that Reading and Leeds haven't been
trying. No, they had their own campaign, didn't they? With some pop stars involved.
Well, they've done a lot of environmentally focused stuff. I particularly ramped that up this year, trying to make the event more sustainable and on-site, particularly trying to remind people that they should really take all their rubbish and their tents, etc., away with them at the end of the event. And they got Billie Eilish and 21 Pilots involved during the festival to really try to drive that message home. But it does not seem to have worked.
And so, on the back of that, various articles in newspapers and online in the last week about how terrible it was that all of these tents had been left. And as a result of that, we had a couple of organisations coming forward who sort of campaign for a tidier Britain, coming up with some potential solutions. Now, as you've said, the festival community has tried various things over the years to try and hammer home the importance of festival goers taking their tents away with them. So, for example, there has been quite a lot of communication activity. Maybe it's getting through, maybe it isn't. But various bits of research over the years have suggested that a myth goes around the festival site that if you leave your tent, some charity's going to come and take that tent and then go and take it to another part of the world where people could do with the shelter. So actually, you're doing some good by leaving your tents. And that isn't the case. I mean, sometimes there are some charities that do that.
It is and it isn't. I mean, there are charities who go and do that. They take tents away to reuse them at refugee camps.
But
that happens. But the quantity of tents that are dumped at festivals make it impossible for them to take more than a very small percentage. And also, I mean, one of these charities was saying when this happened last year at Reading and Leeds that actually a lot of the tents have been trashed or set on fire. And obviously then are not reusable.
And also, I mean, a lot of them were £10 supermarket tents to start with, which often you can only pretty much put them up once before everything starts snapping and breaking. So yeah, there's the communications activity of saying, look, you need to take your tents away. It doesn't help anybody, you leaving your tents here. So there have been various efforts to try and encourage people to remove their tents at the end of the event. The proposal that's come up, and it's come from an organisation called Clean Up Britain.
Yes, which from what I can tell is just a grumpier version of Keep Britain Tidy.
Of course, Keep Britain Tidy, for non-UK listeners, has been a decades-old campaign.
Oh, yeah, it started in the 70s. It's quite old.
When we were kids, you used to get posters telling you to pick up your litter, and it would always say Keep Britain Tidy at the bottom. And they've actually endorsed this.
Yes.
Even though the idea has come from Clean Up Britain. And so the suggestion is that festivals should start adding a £25 levy on tickets, presumably only camping
tickets.
Only
camping tickets, yeah.
Where festivals make the distinction, and that people don't get their £25 back until they have taken their tent away is the
yes.
proposal.
Which, I mean, that seems on the face of it like a reasonable idea.
But incredibly hard to
yes,
actually implement.
Yes, I think that with a small amount of thought, there are some logistical issues that possibly make it, well, maybe not impossible, but quite hard to implement. I mean, the first being just crowd management. I think people leave festivals a lot faster or all at the same time compared to how they arrive, where it might be a bit more staggered.
Yeah, your point being, as it currently stands, whereas when people are coming into the festival site, obviously you have to check their tickets, but when they're leaving, you just let them all leave en masse, whereas if there was some sort of deposit return system, people would have to be checked out in some way.
Yeah, it's going to cause a lot of queues getting out of the festival.
No one likes queuing when they're leaving a festival.
Also, yeah, people are going to be more grumpy about queuing. The people get really grumpy on the way into a festival, but on the way out, everyone's tired and they're also going back to normal life.
I mean, some festivals have a problem of getting cars off the car park to start with. If you had to queue to get out of the festival site to get into the car park to then join a queue to drive your car off site, you're going to have a lot of annoyed people.
Yes. And I mean, it's also this staffing, because you're going to have people employed to check everyone's bags as they leave the festival.
Also,
which is complicated.
Most of those tents will be housing more than one festival goer.
Yes.
So what do you do about that?
Yes, so do you then have to have a system where you check people on the way in to check if they've got a tent with them so that they can say, I've taken it away with me after? Because, yeah, you might have people who are one person to a tent, but actually, I mean, I've been at festivals with people who've got 10-person tents, and then only one of those 10 people has the tent at the end. So those 9 people not get their money back because they can't prove that they didn't bring a tent with them in the first place.
So lots of logistical challenges. I also kind of think that if you started doing that, more affluent festival goers who potentially, if the communications is getting through that no charity is coming for your tent, may at least feel a little bit bad about leaving their tent. And I think there is an element with all of these things that if the first round of people to leave the site leave their tents, then everyone else is much more likely to leave their tents. Because I think most people now will probably know you're not meant to leave your tent.
Yeah.
But if you're surrounded by tents that have been left, I think you're probably more likely to go, oh, screw it, I'm going to leave my tent. But if you started having this £25 system, quite a lot of those people, I think, would start to think, oh, well, I've paid my £25, someone else can deal with my tent.
£25 is a pretty good rate for picking up a tent.
Now, it may be that you could just say, well, maybe, even though that's not the ultimate aim of this taxing thing, maybe it would mean that you could hire people to do a bit of a better job of recycling those tents, or what bits of those tents can be recycled. And so it would still be a better situation. But I mean, ultimately, the aim here isn't that people remember to take their tents away and then put them in the bin. The idea here is encouraging people not to buy £10 tents that you only use once, to buy a decent tent that you will use for 60 festivals over the next 10 years. So you're actually taking it home, drying it out and all of that. So if it just meant that lots of people were like, oh, well, I've paid my £25, I'm allowed to leave my tent now, and then all of those end up in landfill, we haven't really achieved much.
Yes, I mean, that was part of the Association of Independent Festivals campaign earlier this year. They were putting pressure on retailers to stop selling these really cheap tents and other kind of camping equipment that was clearly designed to just be chucked away at the end of the event.
So it's a hard one to know. I think every idea should be considered. As we record this podcast, Reading and Leeds haven't responded to this, obviously. Although it's not just a Reading Leeds problem, this is back in the news because of the Reading Festival and the Leeds Festival.
Well, certainly, I mean, obviously the two big festivals that everyone knows are Glastonbury and the Reading and Leeds. So those are the two that are going to get the focus from this either way.
I'm not sure this is the solution, but obviously the festival sector needs to continue talking about this, and maybe the problem is bigger than the festival sector because it's a case of just getting people tuned into the idea that buying cheap disposable tents and then sticking them in a landfill site is generally a bad idea. But then that's changing the mentality of millions of people, isn't it? So that's
yes.
quite a big ask. And probably we can't just expect Festival Republic to take
true.
On that.
And I think, yes, the disposable culture is wider than just tents at festivals. And it's not, just what I said earlier, It's not just young people. It's across society. People are... There are lots of improvements in people's environmentally friendly outlook. A lot of people are definitely changing their behaviours, but a lot of people are still not. I have recently seen many people just throw drinks bottles out of cars. That's a weird thing to do, isn't it? There's definitely somewhere to put that until you get home.
You need to become a member of Clean Up Britain. Then you can get angry about
such things.
I do seem
very angry.
And of course, it may simply be that when it comes to communications, although it does feel like lots of festivals, including Reading Leeds, have done quite a lot of comms around this in recent years. In some ways, when you're trying to get a message across, you can never say it too often.
Yeah.
It may simply be that you need to keep on doing that communications and do it ever more prolifically every year to hammer home there is no charity coming to date your tent, and you just leaving it is a massive pain. And even just taking it home and sticking it in the bin isn't much better either. Get yourself a proper tent. Maybe festival websites should start selling good reusable tents, or at least have a page on their site where these are tents we would recommend that you can use for lots of festivals. They're relatively easy to dry off and pack away.
Maybe I think that's it. Recommending tents that are easy to pack away, because packing tents away is a pain, isn't it?
It is. So maybe that's something they could consider. But still, £25 levy, even though I think we've pretty much come up with quite a long list of reasons why that's a bad idea. But we're not saying it shouldn't be considered.
It's still an idea.
It is an idea.
And ideas are good.
So think about it.
Before we get to our last story today, let's plug some stuff.
Let's plug
some
stuff.
What are you doing in the coming weeks?
The coming weeks.
Yeah.
We have lots of things on the go. We talked about quite a lot of this on last week's set list. But let's quickly recap some of the things we've got going on in September. So the CMU Insight seminars are back. We have 3 seminars happening over a series of Monday evenings in London at the London HQ of Lewis Silkin, our very kind hosts. So those kick off on the 16th of September. And we have our How Music Rights Work seminar, our How Music Licensing Work seminar, and our Music Rights Sector seminar, all happening over 3 Monday evenings. You can either buy a ticket that gets you into everything, or you can check in to individual seminars, whichever you prefer. So it would be great to see you at that. Don't forget that Podcast Maker Weekend is happening at King's Place, also in London, as part of the London Podcast Festival on the 15th of September. Well, actually, it's the 14th and the 15th, because it's a weekend.
Yeah.
Weekends are usually 2 days. My session is quite early on the Sunday, on the 15th of September, looking at how you get music into your podcasts legally.
Have you worked out how yet?
Yeah, just have cheesy production music.
Okay.
I think that's the solution.
Well,
there.
I spoiled that then. Don't go.
So do come. I'm going to say lots
do
more
Do go. The
stuff.
London Podcast Festival looks really good this year.
Also,
and
it's not
I
just
can't
me.
Go and it's really like, oh, it's annoying me.
It's not just me talking. So do come along to that. We have stuff happening at Reaper Barn Festival in Hamburg and Pivotal in Birmingham this month as well. And as part of the Pivotal Festival in Birmingham, the Artist Entrepreneur Day that we present at CMU DIY in partnership with the Featured Artist Coalition, we have 3, count them, three Artist Entrepreneur Days coming up this year.
Wow.
So the first one is as part of Pivotal in Birmingham. So that's in September. So if you're coming to Pivotal, do look out. Basically, FAC and AWOL have their own house at Pivotal and will be pretty much running the full Artist Entrepreneur Day as part of the programme in that venue. But also, this is good because this is non-London activity, because I know a lot of our stuff's in London. I apologise for that. But we've also got Artist Entrepreneur Days coming up over the next couple of months in Manchester and Newcastle. And I'll have more information about those probably, I think next week we might be having a special edition. But whenever the next proper set list happens, I'll have more details about the Manchester and Newcastle editions of our Artist Entrepreneur Day.
You can find links to more information about all of those events, plus everything we've discussed on the show this week at setlistpodcast.com. The show notes for this episode will be right there at the top. Click on them, click on all the links, and your life will be 78% better. And finally this week, the company behind irritating children's song phenomenon Baby Shark has been accused of theft by a guy who's been singing it already for 20 years. It's an open and shut case, you might think, but that is probably because you have never been an American child.
So this lawsuit involves the South Korean company Pingfong, who are the firm behind the recent Baby Shark phenomenon. You would know that probably if you've ever seen the Baby Shark video. Is there anyone who hasn't ever seen the Baby Shark video or one of the Baby Shark videos?
If you have children, then it probably occupies most of your brain. It's the sort of song I've discovered where you suddenly realise that you've just been whistling it for an hour.
It is very catchy.
And then you realise and you think, oh,
but
not again.
At the start of the video and the end of the video, it does say Pink Fong, doesn't
yeah.
it? In quite a irritating way. So you probably are aware.
Oh, it's irritating throughout.
That this company,
from beginning to end,
Pink Fong made these Baby Shark videos. It became a global phenomenon. And of course, there have since been spin-offs. So apparently there's a Baby Shark live show coming. Don't even know what that means. And there was a Baby Shark cereal, wasn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, Kellogg's. Limited edition.
Teaming
had
up.
Had marshmallows in it. Shouldn't be allowed.
With this company, Ping Fong, and obviously quite distinct cartoon in the video. So that's also being replicated in all of these Baby Shark spin-offs. But the crucial point is that although it is Ping Fong's Baby Shark that has become this global thing, and all these spin-offs are now occurring, the song itself predates the Ping Fong videos by quite some way. And this guy, who has a slightly confusing name, Johnny Only,
yeah,
which means when you're writing about it, you're constantly saying only, and it looks kind of weird in the middle of a sentence. He has been performing Baby Shark, including in a YouTube video, for many, many years. Well, I think the YouTube video was a few years ago, wasn't
yeah.
it? But he's been performing it live for many, many years before that. And he reckons that Pink Fong have ripped off Baby Shark from him, or I should say they have ripped off his specific version of Baby Shark.
Yes, because it's quite complicated, all of this. Baby Shark, no one really knows who wrote Baby Shark or where it came from, because it kind of emerged out of US summer camps. It's sort of it's a campfire chant, and no one's really sure when it emerged. There's a theory that it was influenced by Jaws, the film. So it's been around since at least then, which is that's the mid-70s. So that's quite a long time. Now, that original version is very different. Well, not very different. It's a similar sort of chant.
It goes on longer.
It goes on longer, and there's a lot of dismemberment in it.
Yes,
because
so
it's sort of, the song is about coming across a shark and then being eaten limb by limb.
Obviously, the version, if you've seen the Pink Fong video, it has a dance to go with it, doesn't it?
So it's aimed at toddlers.
It's the video, yes, the Pink Fong version is aimed at toddlers, and there are the movements that go with the song. So basically, as you're going through the shark family, you're making slightly different actions as you go. But it turns out the original version of it, because I watched a video of this on the old YouTubes once this case mm-hmm. had been filed, and I found some American teenagers, I think on a summer camp,
yeah,
doing the full version. And so, yeah, so after you've gone through the family, baby, mummy, daddy, grandma, grandpa,
yeah,
you're right, yeah, the narrator of the song is then being eaten by a shark. And I think the point is that first of all, you eat the arm, so then you do the actions with your arm behind your back, and then they eat your leg. You're doing this standing up.
Yeah.
So then you start hopping. And then there's a bit at the end where they pretend to be performing CPR because this person's now dying from their shark wounds. And then the CPR doesn't work, so you then start doing the sort of the pumping of the heart with more speed. And then I think obviously there were, because this is just a chant that has evolved over years, I think there were probably quite a lot of different versions of it.
Yes.
But the version I saw, it ended up with them going up to heaven, was the final version, having been killed by the shark. But as you say, the Pink Fong version is aimed at very young children, for whom, I mean, I don't know, you hang out with very young children, would they quite enjoy the idea of having
that probably requires context.
Having arms and legs bitten off. Would they enjoy that?
Yeah, probably.
But crucially, the Pink Fong version stops after introducing the family. Well, in that version, the sharks go hunting but don't actually catch anybody.
Yeah.
Crucially.
Yeah.
There is no legs or arms being eaten.
So as the story goes, according to Johnny Only, about 20 years ago, he thought, it's a good song, but
lots of movements,
lots
kids
of movement,
like movements.
Kids like dancing and movement, but it has all this dismemberment in it, and that's an issue because he has quite a young audience, and he wanted to be able to perform it to younger children. And so he rewrote it, like as you just described, with more of a focus on the family and less of a focus on the death. And he has been performing that for all this time. For a lot of children in America, they know him as the baby shark guy. So he has, you know, it's not that he's just come out of nowhere exactly, although I don't know exactly how massively famous he is in the States. But he reckons that his version and Pink Fong's version are too similar for it to be a coincidence.
So now we can have a bit of copyright law in the middle of our baby shark story, because of course, if you take an existing song and then you change it, so you change the lyrics.
Yeah.
He also says that he slightly changed the rhythm as well, didn't he?
Yes.
Which is also in the Pink Fong version. If you take an existing song, but you change it, you create what we would call a derivative work, and a new copyright exists in your version, which is separate from the copyright that exists in the other version. And that's core to this lawsuit, because what this Johnny Olney is saying is, okay, we don't know who wrote the original Baby Shark song. It may not have been one person. It may have been that lines were added over a number of years. So it's not that he's claiming to own the copyright in Baby Shark in its entirety. But what he's saying is he took the version that people used to sing at summer camps, adapted it, created a new version, and that Pink Fong haven't taken the generic version that was sung at all of these places. They've specifically taken his version. There are actually some differences between his version and the version in the Pink Fong videos.
Yes.
But he's basically saying, you took my version. Okay, maybe you made some further changes to it, but crucially, a new copyright would exist in his version. And if, as he is alleging, Pink Fong took his version, even if they then made some additional changes to it, they would need his permission to do that. They didn't have it, hence the lawsuit.
Yes. So he reckons he's been doing this song for a couple of decades. He actually only recorded and published it in 2011. He made a YouTube video for it the same year. So it's been there since before the Pink Fong version. And you can find various other versions on YouTube that are similar, that predate his 2011 version. But that's a whole complication that perhaps we won't go into right now. But clearly, it's a song that, because it's just sort of a campfire song that you can sing with kids, lots of people do it. Lots of people do a similar version of it. But everyone has their own little differences. Like you say, people adapt it and change the actions and change perhaps what happens in the song for different audiences, or just because they only kind of half remember it. And so it develops over time.
So Pink Fong is owned by a company called Smart Study, and they dismissed Johnny Only's claims and allegations, insisting that Pink Fong's Baby Shark is based on a traditional sing-along chant which has passed into the public domain. Actually, that's quite an interesting statement. I mean, I have no idea what South Korean copyright law says. But, I mean, from an American perspective, or particularly from a European perspective, I guess, somebody came up with the original song.
Mm.
We don't know who that is. But technically, well, we would call that in Europe an orphan work.
Yeah.
So it's something where, because to be public domain, it would have been in copyright, and then however many years copyright lasts for would have passed, and it would have become public domain, and now it's no longer protected by copyright. Whereas, assuming this song emerged, which is what people seem to be suggesting, in the 70s, maybe go back to the 60s, but the chances are that whoever originally came up with it, and there must have been somebody.
Yes.
Or a team of people.
It can't have been a spontaneous thing at all summer camps across America.
So whoever originally came up with it probably is either still alive or has not been dead for more than 70 years, which would therefore technically mean, under European copyright law, that it is still in copyright. It's just that we don't know who owns it.
Yeah.
So we would call that an orphan work. And orphan works are a nightmare for copyright law, because what do you do with it, and what happens if somebody suddenly comes out of the woodwork and says, hang on, I wrote that song, I want 70 years worth of damages. Now, there are all sorts of complications to go around the world to say, I have no idea what South Korean copyright law would say. I suppose in America, which is where we're assuming it originated, there is some copyright registration in America. So you could say, well, it wasn't registered, therefore the copyright doesn't exist, which, depending on when it was written, may or may not be true. So whether or not saying it's clearly public domain, I'm not sure it's quite as simple as that. But I think basically what they are saying is, as you kind of alluded to, no one knows who wrote this song. There are all sorts of different versions of it. Yes, Pink Fong's version is quite similar to Johnny Only's version. But having said that, there are lots of different versions around the internet, some of which have all of the legs and arms being bitten off, some of which are more like the Johnny Only version.
I mean, there are some things you go on, like my son asked for Baby Shark cartoon on Amazon Prime recently, and I was like, oh God, I can't believe they made one of those. And I put it on, I was like, well, this isn't Pink Fong, this is someone else, definitely.
This is somebody else
capitalizing on that. And then I that was where I thought, well, there's some copyright infringement going on there. But then who's copyright? And perhaps Pinkfong, having made this defence that it's just public domain, well, they can't really then argue that they're being ripped off.
When other people then arrive with their own rip-off videos, which aren't rip-off videos because it's public domain, remember.
Except
it can't be. It's complicated. Who would have known such an annoying song for young children could be so complicated from a copyright perspective? But this lawsuit has been filed in the courts in Korea, where Pinkfong is based.
Yeah, the first hearing in this case actually took place last month at the Seoul Central District Court. And the next stage is that the Korea Copyright Commission is set to review both songs before the case can progress further. But Johnny Only is adamant that it's definitely a rip-off. It's definitely his song that they've used as the template for theirs. Him and his attorney are both very hopeful for a win.
So we will watch this case as it goes through the motion in the Korean courts. And in the meantime, thanks to us talking about it here on Setlist, you will now have the Baby Shark song stuck in your head on a loop for at least the next 17 hours. So that's fun.
That's all we've got time for this week. If you've got any questions or comments on this week's episode, if you have a working knowledge of South Korean copyright law, do write in.
Yeah, what do they do about orphan works? Tell us.
You can email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.